The editors of legacy newspapers' arts sections can be a gloomy bunch. On top of their sensitive aesthetes' dispositions, sadly, they're often the first casualties when management wields the axe. Today, a conversation with an arts desk chief who's a heartening exception to the rule. Plus, a magazine proving the Midwest is more than flyover country, and Edward Enninful's Vogue hits the newsstands. That's all ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. The arts sections of the world's newspapers aren't what they used to be. Thinner, poorer, often understaffed, they've too often served as canaries in the print coal mine as revenues have declined. It's a shame, because their pages have been a platform for some of the best newspaper writing. Luckily, and as is the case with so many aspects of print journalism, the New York Times is a holdout when it comes to investing in culture reporting. The Times is especially keen on expanding its arts operation in Europe. Overseeing that growth is Matthew Anderson. He was the editor of BBC Culture before joining the Times in July of this year as European Culture Editor. He joined Fernando Augusto Pacheco in the studio to talk about the job.
So I've been with the New York Times for 3 months now, and I joined from the BBC where I was for 10 years. So I spent my first 6 weeks in New York getting settled in, and then the next 6 weeks I've been based in the bureau here in London, where I'll be based for the future.
What sort of presence do they have in Europe? Do you think they're kind of expanding or?
Totally. Well, that's the reason why they're taking on a European culture editor. So the Times has very aggressive targets for growth internationally. So it's trying to stop thinking of itself as an American newspaper and think of itself as a sort of global digital-first news organization. And growth in Europe is an important part of that. My position is primarily to build out our culture report so that it's something that will be attractive to European readers. It's felt that a lot of what we do in terms of covering culture in America is very good, but there just wasn't enough of it in Europe, and that's where I come into it.
Well, and you have so much to choose as well in a city like London or even in Germany, a country that you admire quite a lot.
Yeah, of course. I mean, one of the things actually that I'm finding is it's just so huge, really. It covers everything from, you know, from what's going on in Portugal to what's happening in Russia. It's culture in all its forms. So like what's on TV in Spain to what's at, you know, sort of an avant-garde theatre in Copenhagen. It's all covered under that rubric. So we have to be very careful about what stories we choose to tell for that audience. But it's exciting as well. There's so much to it. I'm enjoying myself very much.
And something we've been discussing on The Stack, you know, especially, you know, after Trump, some well-known brands like the New York Times, for example, subscriptions are rising. So there's still very much, you know, the power of print is still there. And a lot of people say print is dying, which is actually in some cases quite the opposite in some ways.
Definitely. I think the Times is very clear that it wants to think of itself as a digital first organization, but the newspapers are still very important. We have two newspapers that we think about. One is the domestic one, which is for the US, and there's also the international edition of the New York Times as well. Because that is less focused on sort of breaking news, it assumes the reader is getting that kind of information digitally, but it takes a step back and there's much more analysis and features and other types of reporting and journalism in it. And because of that, the culture offering is very important for that paper. So it's great to be able to do those sorts of stories and see them in print.
I know it's early days since you arrived at the New York Times, but tell us, for example, which kind of stories are you planning to cover or that you have covered? Perhaps an interesting feature that you've done recently.
Sure. Well, we've just done a story this week, which was about Beatrix Ruff, who was the director of the Stedelijk Museum in Amsterdam. And she stepped it down amid some controversy a couple of weeks ago, and she hadn't spoken to any media organizations yet. But Nina Siegel, a great journalist who I've been working with in Amsterdam, she was able to secure an exclusive interview with her and also to conduct a fairly serious investigation into what went on there. And it's been great, actually, to be able to work in an organization where you can do these kinds of things. I think in a lot of organizations, the arts is considered something maybe a bit sort of fluffy, maybe for a bit of texture in your report. And then the serious journalism, that takes place in business economics and, you know, other sorts of parts of current affairs. But I love that at the Times, the arts is considered just as important and just as much an area in which you would put a reporter on an investigation, you know, we ran the investigation for about 2.5-3 weeks. Nina was working on it very, very solidly. And I love being part of an organization that will actually give you the time and the resources and the support to do something like that.
Because that's what I was going to ask, because I do think the culture section of a paper or of a magazine is extremely important. And I was going to ask if the New York Times give this importance and even, you know, the appropriate budget for it as well.
My feeling is that it's very well resourced, and that in terms of the senior management and senior editors in the on the paper, they seem very into it. So it's nice to be part of an organization where what you do is valued and is a really core part of the offering.
As a fan of the paper, I have to mention to you, you know, I do love when they do those kind of fall previews of something. So they have so many supplements with full of art. I mean, it's an incredible job. I mean, and it's about almost 100 pages or
I know,
something.
Well, actually, it was quite interesting because when I was in New York settling in, they were closing the fall preview edition, which, as you say, it's absolutely massive. You don't get it in print outside of the US, unfortunately. It's just for the US edition. But the amount of work that goes into that is mind-boggling. And, you know, as you say, it's hundreds of pages of listings, features, all sorts of things in there. But it is, you know, it's incredible sort of force of will that it requires, you know, it to come together. But it's really satisfying when you see it. I actually read it on the plane home from New York when I was coming back to London. And it just about, you know, got me through a whole transatlantic journey. So it's fairly substantial offering there.
Yes, it is quite amazing. And of course, I know you're a big fan of print media, and you brought actually some titles for us to review. And you mentioned that you like Germany, so do you have some German titles, perhaps?
I've got one. It's the Frankfurter Allgemeine Quarterly. So, of course, the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung is a very famous, respected newspaper in Germany. But the Quarterly, I hadn't actually ever heard of it, but I just picked it up on a newsstand when I was there. And it's really good. It's very different from the paper. The paper, to my taste, can be a bit starchy, and it's very conservative, often maybe a little pompous. But this magazine is not at all. I mean, I think it's definitely aimed at a younger reader. It's very focused on the future, and it's very optimistic about the future, which is actually not really a very German thing to be. It's a great read, actually, and I bought it for a long train journey, and yeah, it got me through just about the whole thing. So
I've noticed something already. So of course you have the, you know, they have this very old font, but actually the magazine looks quite fresh.
It does, actually.
Different fonts and
totally. Actually, I think readers of Monocle will find it a little bit familiar, some of it. It's definitely got that kind of mood or atmosphere to it, reflected in some of the graphic design. But you know, I think they do it well. I think they pull it off.
That's a good choice. What about, you have a magazine called Even?
Yes.
I haven't heard of this one, actually.
No, so I think this is a fantastic magazine. Full disclosure, it is actually edited by a good friend of mine and colleague of mine at the New York Times, Jason Farrago. It's an art magazine in principle, but all of the stories in there very much are about connecting art to real issues in the real world. So there's a fantastic long feature, and it's probably about 10,000 words, I would think, which is about Chinese artists. So of course, at the Guggenheim in New York at the moment, there's a big exhibition of Chinese art, basically from Tiananmen Square until now. And so in Even, they've chosen four key Chinese artists that you should know, basically if you want to understand what Chinese art from that period until now is all about. And it goes into a lot of depth on it, but it's never too academic, and on the other hand, it's also not too patronizing either. So I thought that was very well done. It's also got some good interviews with some big artists who are the kind of people who in the next few years I think we're going to be hearing a lot about. Camille Henrot is one. She's got a massive show at the Palais de Tokyo, which just opened there, which she's got the Carte Blanche, which is basically where they turn over the whole museum to one artist. She's got that at the moment. She's very young. She's less than, I think she's sort of 38 or 39 years old. So incredible to have that at that point in her career. And the depth of the interview with her is amazing. It's not the sort of thing you would probably get sort of in a mainstream mass market publication. I don't think we could go into that level of depth in the New York Times, for instance. But I'm glad that there is a space for someone to do that.
Well, and it's an American base, but hopefully you can find in those indie magazine stores here in the UK as well.
Definitely. I mean, it's kind of hard to get hold of, but you can usually get it. It was like, say, if you were to go in the gift shop of like Tate Modern or the MoMA, that kind of thing, and indie distributors as well, as you say.
Great tip. And then we have an old favorite here from our guest, the London Review of Books.
Yes, I just love it. in a way, it's such is quite a weird publication. I think it's quite British in a way that it's so quirky and at the same time so established and feels like it's sort of always been there. But I love it. I always read it. I love its sort of bonkers editorial direction. I love that they review things when they get to them. And I think they always have incredible writers and give them the space to write things really interestingly.
Interesting that, you know, now you're based here in London. Do you see any difference between print media in the US and the UK? Maybe I'm just guessing, but one thing in the UK, there's quite a lot of papers, actually. Because in the US, I mean, the New York Times, you have perhaps the Wall Street Journal. I think here in the UK, you have kind of more titles that are...
For sure. Actually, one thing, I was actually kind of horrified when I was in New York that, for instance, like something like New York Magazine, which is a magazine that I love, you can't get that in London anywhere. It was, once again, it was the full preview issue while I was there in New York, so I really wanted to get a hold of a copy of it. And it was actually really, really difficult to find one. I mean, there are sort of like little kiosks on the street, but they mostly seem to be selling gum and sweets and things like that. There's a very few titles in them. And as you say, it's the Times and the Journal and like maybe the Washington Post and a few kind of like tabloidy, you know, magazines and whatever. But if you're you know, a print person and you're into reading serious magazines, it's actually really, really difficult. Once again, while I was there, I wanted to get my hands on Die Zeit, which is a German newspaper, which I usually read every week. But it was just totally impossible to find. And in the end, I found a news agent right downtown that had it, but I sort of couldn't really be bothered going down there to get it. But it was, you know, it required a lot of research and just effort on my part to track it down.
In some ways, that's quite sad because I know in the US, subscription is super important for magazines. But I'm not the subscription kind of guy. I do like to go to a news agent and choose a magazine by its cover or, you know, just browsing around. I think that's so important.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, maybe it is just a difference in the nature of the market. But as you say, then if you don't have a place you can go and look at and just let something take your fancy and whatever, I think then you are missing out.
But Matthew, very good to hear that New York Times, you know, they put you as the European culture editor. Do you have any plans, something that you would like to mention, any upcoming stories perhaps?
Well, we've got, as I was saying before, about working with sort of more with investigative reporters and that kind of thing. We've got a big one coming up, which I can't say too much about, but which will be sort of that kind of story. So glad to be working on something like that. And then, I mean, at the moment, I'm on the lookout for freelance journalists and people all over the continent, really, who have got interesting perspectives and interesting stories to tell in all sorts of areas where the Times hasn't done things before. So, I mean, we're looking for reporters, features writers, critics, all the different sorts of varieties of journalism that you can do in the arts and culture. You know, we're keen to do them from all over the continent. So, yeah, watch this space for more of that.
Matthew Anderson there in conversation with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Both within the US and internationally, the Midwest's regional reputation is ambiguous. Those on the continent's coast tend to regard it with a mixture of condescension and outright contempt, viewing it as a place of both staid homeliness and, since the 2016 election, threatening conservatism. This, of course, is an unfair generalisation of a region whose social and political diversity matches its vast geographical scope. The New Territory, a quarterly publication billed as the magazine of the lower Midwest, sets out to reflect this diversity in its reporting. A single issue carries stories ranging from the consequences of an Asian carp invasion in Arkansas to the impact of new liquor laws in Oklahoma. Tina Casagrande is the publisher and editor-in-chief of the title, and she joined Fernando again in the studio to tell us more about it.
Tina, a pleasure to welcome here on The Stack. And I received a copy of your beautiful magazine, The New Territory, the magazine of the lower Midwest. I have to say, first of all, the magazine looks beautiful, and it's from the part of the US that, I have to be honest, I don't know much about it. Tell us about your idea for the magazine. I have issue 3, but, you know, if you can bring us back to when you started.
I started out doing freelance environmental journalism, which is still my passion, but I was really frustrated by not having a place where I could consistently be telling the long-form stories that I really loved writing. And I know a lot of journalists hope to get to a point where they can write long 5,000-10,000-word stories. And there's plenty of magazines that exist that publish that kind of content, but I really wanted to do something for my region where I grew up, which is essentially like the Ozarks and the Great Plains in the middle of the U.S. And it just seemed so important to me to have something for our region, because there's nothing that exists like this, even for individual states, but for the region as a whole, we don't even have that much of a cohesive culture like you might think of the American South or the New England states or out west. So that's why I started it. I waited around a couple years hoping somebody else would start it so I could just write for it. But then I realized I'm really in a pretty good position to do it myself for now. So that's the origin of the new territory.
And, you know, regional journalism is also very important. Of course, your magazine is not necessarily like a local paper or something, but even here in the UK or all over Europe, you know, regional journalism is going through process sometimes, you know, a lot of them are closing down, but a lot of people say that they were actually very important for their community as well. Do you see your publication as well as doing, also besides being just a beautiful title, also doing a service for the community?
Absolutely, yeah. That speaks to the fact that the Midwest hasn't had so much of a regional identity. You know, we call ourselves the Lower Midwest to differentiate from, say, like the Great Lakes region, because we're definitely more of a Western type of Midwest, right? So that's part of what I'm trying to do, is this culture work to provide a platform, not only for journalism, but we also have a literature section, and we try to do things that engage literature writers as well. So yeah, we're we're doing a lot, but all focused on our region. So, and I think it's so important. Just, I don't want to sound too egotistical, because I don't think one little quarterly magazine is going to help solve like brain drain, for instance. But a lot of people move away from the Midwest and from rural places because they want to find success and want to connect with people who are more connected culturally. And often they go to the coasts in the U.S. And I think so much great stuff is happening here that I want to document it, and I want to be a part of it, and I want to give some people here something they can point to and say, like, hey, we have something sophisticated and beautiful that we can really call our own regionally. So that's what I'm trying to do.
I'm going to ask a little bit about the business model of the magazine. So do you guys sell on newsstands, or do you work with subscription? And someone from outside the Lower Midwest, how can they grab a copy of the magazine?
So we primarily are supported by our subscribers. You know, it's a pretty premium price, $15 a copy or $60 for a yearly quarterly subscription. We also ideally would have more sponsors than we currently have. It's been a bit of a chicken and egg situation where I felt like our subscriber numbers weren't high enough where I could go out and try seeking sponsors, but we really do need that to stay alive financially. And then we also are on some newsstands. We work with about 15 stockists around the country, but all of that is direct distribution for now. We do have an international subscription option, as well as subscriptions and sequel copy orders on our website.
And you mentioned, of course, you know, you're very interested in environmental issues. And you can see that in the magazine. For example, I have in issue 3, there's an interesting story about Asian carp in Arkansas. Apparently, at that time in the 60s, people said that it would solve all environmental problems. Can you talk a bit more about the story? It's quite an interesting feature.
Oh, yeah, that's one of my favorite features. It's actually written by a Canadian journalist. He's working on a book about Asian carp, which is a big problem in the U.S. and Great Lakes as an invasive species. And the story kind of turns our idea and notion of Rachel Carson as a environmentalist a bit on its head, just in terms of how people followed her advice to stop using chemicals to control invasive species or try to correct environmental issues. So there were a lot of invasive plants that were taking over waterways. So people said, hey, let's introduce a fish that will eat them naturally. But then the fish started taking over the water ecosystems. And it's a beautifully told story, really rooted in Arkansas and how one fish farmer was really well-intentioned and really wanted to do right by the environment and make a good business out of it, but unintentionally has created a huge problem that is costing states so much of their budget just trying to control this fish now, decades later.
Also, Tina, I would like to ask you, if you don't mind perhaps sharing a couple of stories that are in your latest issue, and remind me, which one is that?
Yeah, so we have come out with issue 4, and we're sitting on issue 5 right now. We've been sitting on it for a few months trying to get enough money to go and send it to print. But I'll talk about issue 5 because I'm really excited about it. Our theme for this issue, and all of our themes come about organically, but we've titled this one Brave New World, in part because we have a lot of stories that are talking about communities that are either trying to come up or have been brought about more organically or maybe are not well understood. So One feature is about the Missouri River and kind of, it's titled Muddy Logic, and it's all about everything from the protests at Standing Rock at the headwaters of the Missouri all the way down through some of the more tamed parts of the river all the way down to St. Louis. So that's about 3,000 miles worth of culture that we're looking at in one large feature. Another is a great story by Patrick Minelli, who's also in issue 3, and he's looking at the history of this man who came to a very rural part of Iowa and established essentially a colony of people who were following him religiously, and he got very power hungry, and essentially his followers were reduced to pure poverty and nothing and kind of revolted against him. And so that's a town called Preparation, Iowa, which is, you know, now totally vacant, and I think it's a state park. But that's another really exciting story that gets very literary in the way that it's told, and Patrick comes up as a character occasionally in it, as it was kind of written a little bit after the election of Donald Trump, and he was trying to understand how he might have been just as interested in following someone who had beliefs that he agreed with, but that others might have found controversial. So,
Tina, I would like to ask you a question that I asked most of our guests. Which other magazine titles are you inspired or perhaps you're just a fan to read over a weekend, for example?
I would say that Harper's really influenced the early creation of the New Territory, and I still love their journalism so much. I am inspired by what Kai Brock is doing with Offscreen Magazine. There's so many. I've been reading a lot of Fast Company lately, actually. It's kind of inspiring to learn what other entrepreneurs are doing. And then I picked up this title from a bookstore recently. I think it's called Gup, or pronounced that way, and it's a photography magazine that's so beautiful, and the text is short, but it's very pithy and fascinating how they examine these art photographers. So that's a short selection. The stack's always higher than I can keep up with.
Tina Casagrande there in conversation with Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Issue 4 of The New Territory. It's out now. When Edward Enninful was confirmed as the new editor of British Vogue back in April, the fashion industry immediately began to speculate. What changes would the magazine's first black editor bring to the title? Well, this week we found out. The first issue under Enninful's command hit the newsstands on Thursday, with British mixed race model Adwoa Aboah on the cover. Fernando was first in line, once again, at the kiosk to pick up his copy. Here he is talking about it with Monocle's Marco Sippi.
So I went this morning to the newsstand here in London and I bought the new British Vogue, the December issue, which is the first under the command of their new editor, Edward Enninful. And even the newsagent guy said, well, Fernando, you're lucky because people were really looking forward to see it. And I have to say, I'm not disappointed. The star of the cover, I have to say, is British model Adwoa Aboah in a beautiful photo shoot by Steven Meisel. You can see the difference already in the cover.
Already on the cover.
Absolutely. It's very 70s, quite chic, and I can see that Vogue under Edward Enninful is going to be, how can I say, a little bit less predictable as it was under Alexandra Schumann. And I'm not saying anything bad against her. I think she did a very efficient, very good magazine with quite good sales as well. But British Vogue is less West London and a bit more international and fashion.
So how would you describe those main changes then?
Well, first of all, I think there's been a lot of criticism in the past that especially British Vogue didn't have enough diversity of models. I mean, if you look at this issue, it's something completely different already in terms of diversity. Of course, you have the usual Cara Delevingne's, but you also have an interview of Naomi Campbell interviewing Sadiq Khan, the mayor of London. So perhaps the magazine might become even a bit more political, trying to be a little bit younger and less stuffier as well. I was very much impressed. There's even a nice photo shoot by Jürgen Teller called Remain. And we know very much about this word, especially after all the Brexit chat. So I think it's a new fashion magazine for Remain people, perhaps.
What other highlights would you mention from that brand new edition of that magazine?
I do like the photography. The photo shoot with Adwoa Aboah is just marvelous. And another thing that I've noticed, they tweaked a little bit the font. I don't know actually the name of the font, but it feels cooler. And I feel also that there's also a tribute to the 70s Vogue in terms of font, in terms of some of the photo shoots. So yeah, it's a very good change.
What do you expect from the future then? I think it's interesting that you mentioned that the British Vogue may be more surprising in the future and less predictable.
Absolutely. I think that that would be the biggest change, because before that, again, as I said, it wasn't a bad magazine at all. But usually the covers would be, I don't know, Kate Moss, Alexa Chung. There was not so much of a difference. So you were not saying, oh my God, who is going to be in Vogue cover? But I think now you have this feeling. And perhaps British Vogue will become more like their counterparts, the French and the Italian ones, which are more daring and more surprising as well.
Well, what do you expect from the future then? Obviously, this is a great, exciting moment for Vogue magazine. I'm wondering, here on Monocle 24, we also mentioned that, for example, in the US, Teen Vogue print edition shut down, was closed. So what does the future look for the British Vogue, for example, what you're holding now in your hands?
It's safe as always. I think what's happening in Condé Nast, I think they're having a look at all their titles and they're concentrating, you know, the budget and this kind of things in the titles that matter the most, which includes Vogue and Vanity Fair, for example. So the future of Vogue is very much assured. You know, there was a problem with Teen Vogue, which was a shame. But again, let's remind, the circulation was not very high and they would still have an online presence. So Condé Nast, of course, they're moving digital, but they know the value of print. And when you see a beautiful product like this Vogue, you can see that they still care. And the magazine is a lot of pages, Marcus. I can count almost like 350 pages.
And just finally, Fernanda, what would you like to see other fashion magazines learn, for example, from the work of this brand new editor-in-chief of Vogue magazine and this new print edition of Vogue?
I think just proves that fashion magazines can be exciting as they were. And I have to say, Marcus, you know, we're talking about Vogue UK, but actually I think they got inspired about other magazines as well, including, for example, The Gentlewoman and other indie titles as well. You can see some of their influence here in the magazine, and maybe a change of typeface here and there can always help as well.
That was Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. He's been busy this week in discussion with Marco Sippi. That's it for this week's programme. Thanks to our producers, the always busy Fernando and Henry Reese Sheridan, and our editors Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome. Why not add a little more work onto the in tray of Fernando? You'll find him at fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. My name's Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.